Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
American Grace Brown is keeping busy during her first year of high school. Grace attends West Potomac High School in Alexandria, Virginia. She studies all the required subjects, such as English, history, and mathematics, as well as taking classes in Latin. She also sings in a choral group and plays piano. The school day lasts from about 8 o'clock in the morning to 3 in the afternoon. But because of her many activities, the 14-year-old has no time for a class in physical education, or PE. So Grace is taking that class outside of school and on her own time. She is getting school credit for virtual PE. The idea, as strange as it may sound, is getting support from wearable fitness recording devices or trackers. For many school subjects, tests and textbooks now are available on computers and other electronic devices. So it makes sense that technology also is having an effect on PE equipment. Brown wears a fitness tracker called a Fitbit that the high school provided. She wears the Fitbit on her arm while doing exercises lasting 30 minutes or longer, 3 times a week. She usually does this outside of school hours. Her computer has a software program that records her activity, which she can present for credit.
Internet-based PE classes have been around for well over 10 years. Often they are part of virtual or internet-based schools. Users say the technology has made a new level of accountability possible. Elizabeth Edwards is responsible for internet-based PE at Northern Virginia's Fairfax County Public Schools, which includes Grace's high school. She told the Associated Press the school system is asking students to wear fitness trackers while they do an activity of their choice. They can change the activity as long as it's something that they understand is probably going to get their heart rate up, Edwards said. A PE teacher may not be guiding the Fitbit-wearing students in person, but teachers do lead students' work by setting goals, such as fat burn, using the technology as their eyes and ears. Students also must take part in a weekly 60-minute to 90-minute class with the teacher at school. Teenagers who swim or dance all year may meet the workout requirements without doing anything extra. Grace Brown has been adding light running and bicycle rides to her days.
For Grace, internet-based PE made it possible for her to take 3 elective classes. For others, it is a welcome way to take a required class that some students may find socially or physically difficult. We definitely exercise more in online PE, Brown said. There's a lot of standing around in regular PE. Online, I do much harder workouts. Grace's mother, Rhonda Brown, remembers how hard PE class and softball games were for her because of blindness in one eye. She would like to see Fairfax County go even further and give students permission to avoid PE if they play school sports. We're so stuck in the traditional classroom setting. These kids are burning 2,000 calories during a practice and more at every game, Brown said. I wish the schools would catch up with the times.
The American College of Sports Medicine recently questioned more than 3,000 physical fitness experts. They named wearable technology the top trend in fitness for 2020. It is not clear how many schools are supporting the trend. Technology and the collection of any student data always raises the issue of student privacy concerns. And some Americans worry that students exercising on their own may miss out on important social concepts, such as teamwork. There is a difference between physical activity and physical education, said Chris Hersel. He is a former vice president at Shape America, which wrote national guidelines for physical education. Physical activity is great for the body. We want everybody to move, he said. But physical education is a class where students are taught how to move their body and the social context in which to do that. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Pete Musto.
China and the United States have come to an agreement this month that seemingly begins to bring an end to their two-year trade war. This is good news for many people worldwide. After all, the International Monetary Fund estimates the trade war decreased world economic growth in 2019 to 3%. Instead of the estimated 3.8%. But in Southeast Asia, the question that comes to mind is, what does the end of the U.S.-China trade war mean for Vietnam? The U.S. tariffs on Chinese exports caused many companies to move from China to Vietnam to avoid paying the taxes. As a result, Vietnamese exports to the U.S. increased 28% in the first three quarters of 2019. Also, U.S. President Donald Trump's heated dispute with China meant he was not looking closely at Vietnam's trade policies. Vietnam hopes China will extend U.S. talks, said Fred Burke. He is a managing partner of Baker & McKenzie Vietnam, an international company. In other words, if U.S. officials are busy negotiating with the Chinese, they have less time to deal with what is happening in Vietnam. Trump's big complaint about Vietnam is that it has a large trade surplus with the U.S. That may be the result of Americans choosing to buy Vietnamese exports over the exports of other countries. However, Trump's usual answer to a trade imbalance is tariffs. Vietnam has reason to pay attention. In the past, the U.S. has put tariffs on Vietnamese seafood and metal exports. For a while, it looked like the U.S. might accuse Vietnamese officials of plotting unfairly to keep their currency low to the dollar. The move would permit Vietnam to make products less costly and so increase exports. The U.S. Treasury Department said in a report it would simply keep Vietnam on a list of possible currency manipulators. The U.S. could also put tariffs on Vietnam for trade fraud. Transshipment, a kind of trade fraud, permits Chinese companies to ship their exports through another country, perhaps Vietnam, and sell them on the world market as Vietnamese goods to avoid tariffs. ING, a banking and financial services company, said it was interesting that the Treasury Department did not criticize Vietnam for transshipment in its report. Chris Turner and Francesco Pisole are financial experts at ING. They called the Treasury Department's report accommodative. They added that the U.S. government seemed satisfied by Vietnamese efforts to prevent trade fraud. I'm Susan Shand.
A new study provides scientific evidence to support the idea that stress can cause a person's hair to turn gray. A team from America's Harvard University said the new study is the first to show a clear link between stress and graying hair. The findings were recently published in the journal Nature. Researchers say they discovered a chemical process that can change hair color during times of stress. The process is linked to the body's fight or flight reaction that can happen during dangerous situations. Ya Che Tzu is a professor of stem cell and regenerative biology at Harvard. She said in a statement that the research team was in search of the first scientific confirmation of the commonly held belief that stress can cause gray hair. Everyone has an anecdote to share about how stress affects their body, particularly in their skin and hair, the only tissues we can see from the outside, Sue said. The team used experiments with mice to look at how stress affects stem cells in hair follicles. Most people have about 100,000 hair follicles on their head. The follicles are responsible for making melanocytes, the cells that give hair its color. As people age, melanocyte production is reduced. This causes a person's hair to begin turning gray naturally. At first, the researchers suspected that an immune attack caused by a stressful event might be targeting the melanocyte stem cells. That theory, however, turned out to be false. The mice lacking immune cells still showed signs of graying hair. The team also thought the hormone cortisol, which always increases in the body during times of stress, might be a likely cause. However, when researchers removed the gland that produces the cortisol hormones, the hair of mice still turned gray. The scientists then centered their experiments on the body's sympathetic nervous system. This is the body system that controls fight or flight reactions in dangerous situations. The sympathetic nervous system is made up of a collection of nerves that extend through the body, including the skin. When the mice were subjected to short-term pain or placed in stressful laboratory conditions, these nerves released a chemical called norepinephrine. The chemical then flowed through the stem cells up into the hair follicles, where melanocytes are kept. The researchers found that when the norepinephrine was released, all the melanocyte stem cells were highly activated and changed into pigment-producing cells. This overproduction process resulted in the early loss of color-producing cells. Ya Che Su said the experiments confirmed the team's belief that stress is bad for the body. She added that the results demonstrated the harmful effects are more major than what the researchers had imagined. After just a few days, all of the pigment-regenerating stem cells were lost. Once they're gone, you can't regenerate pigments anymore. The damage is permanent, Su said. The scientists said their research could lead to new treatments for stress-related graying in the future. Graying hair is just one example of how stress affects the body. New experiments could also be carried out in other areas as well, the team said. These could include studies to see whether stress can also cause changes in body tissues. Su said she would also like to study whether stress has a large effect on the overall aging process. We don't know if that is true yet. We are interested in finding out the link, she said. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt was President of the United States during the early years of the 20th century. He was a forceful leader. His national policies led to social reforms and federal protection of nature. His foreign policy led to greater American involvement in world events. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt.
In 1903, Panama declared its independence from Colombia. 15 days later, Panama and the United States signed a treaty. The treaty gave the United States the right to build a canal across Panama. To protect the canal, President Roosevelt declared greater responsibility for a wide area around the canal. The greatest responsibility was financial. Roosevelt said the United States would guarantee repayment of loans made to Latin American countries. He did this to prevent European countries from using the issue of non-payment as an excuse to seize new territory in the Western Hemisphere.
Some Latin American nations were in serious economic trouble. Venezuela was one. At that time, Venezuela owed millions of dollars to Britain and Germany. The Venezuelan ruler refused to make payments on the loans. Britain and Germany decided to use force to get the money. Their ships began blocking Venezuela's ports. When they began shelling coastal areas, President Roosevelt intervened. He urged them to let the International Court of Arbitration at The Hague settle the dispute. They agreed, and the blockade of Venezuela ended.
Less than 2 years later, a similar financial problem arose in the Dominican Republic. Revolutions and dictatorships there prevented repayment of foreign loans. The United States offered a solution. it would take over collection of import taxes at ports in the Dominican Republic. 45% of the money would be paid to the Dominican government. The other 55% would be used to repay loans. The Dominican Republic agreed. The plan succeeded. Some countries in Latin America and the Caribbean questioned the right of the United States to act as policemen for the Western Hemisphere, but none openly opposed President Roosevelt's policy.
Theodore Roosevelt had become president after the assassination of President William McKinley. He completed the last 3 years of McKinley's term. Then he was ready to be elected in his own right. Republican Party leaders, however, were not so sure. Roosevelt had made businessmen angry because of his attempts to control big companies. But he made voters happy because of his fight for social reforms. Roosevelt's only serious competitor for the nomination was a longtime senator and presidential advisor. But the man died before the nominating convention. So Roosevelt won the nomination easily.
The Democratic Party, in the past two elections, had nominated a progressive, Congressman William Jennings Bryan, as its candidate. This time, the Democrats chose a more conservative candidate. He was a New York judge, Alton Parker. Judge Parker had no chance to win the election. Theodore Roosevelt was the best-known man in America. He won easily. On Inauguration Day, Roosevelt made a short speech. He said America's capitalist economic system had done much good for the country, but it also had created a crisis in social relations, and the crisis had to be solved. If we fail, Roosevelt said, the cause of self-government throughout the world will suffer greatly.
During his new term in office, President Roosevelt was able to get Congress to approve two major new laws. One was the Hepburn Act. This law gave the Interstate Commerce Commission power to limit how much railroads could charge for transporting goods. The purpose was to keep the cost of railroad transportation reasonable. The other new law was the Pure Food and Drug Act. This law declared it illegal to make or sell foods and medicines containing harmful chemicals. The purpose was to protect the health of all Americans.
President Roosevelt's most important foreign policy success came as a result of a war between Russia and Japan. At that time, Russia occupied Manchuria in northern China. Japan occupied Korea. Japan wanted control of Manchuria. It needed that area's coal and iron ore. Japan also wanted to end any Russian threat to Korea. So it decided to fight. Japan's navy easily defeated all the Russian fleets sent to the Pacific. But the two sides continued to fight on land. When both began to run out of money, they accepted President Roosevelt's offer to make peace.
Roosevelt invited Japanese and Russian diplomats to meet with him in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He told them his greatest hope and prayer was for them to find a just and lasting peace quickly. A quick settlement, however, was not easy. Japan demanded $600 million for war damages. It also wanted Sakhalin Island. Russia rejected both demands. It had agreed to give up southern Manchuria. Russia would give up nothing else. Negotiations lasted many days. President Roosevelt became more and more angry when neither side would compromise. But he remained calm and kept the talks going. Later, he said, "What I really wanted to do was give an angry shout, jump up, and knock their heads together."
Finally, Roosevelt made a secret appeal to the Emperor of Japan. He asked the Emperor to drop demands for money and for Sakhalin Island. He warned that Russia was ready to fight again if the peace talks failed. The Emperor agreed to drop the demand for money, but he still demanded half of Sakhalin Island. Russia agreed to this compromise. The two sides signed a peace treaty.
Theodore Roosevelt received the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating an end to the Russian-Japanese War. However, his efforts were denounced in Japan. Roosevelt was held responsible for the loss of war damage payments. It was money Japan needed badly. Anti-American riots broke out in some parts of the country. At the same time, tense relations developed between American citizens and Japanese immigrants in California. Poor Japanese immigrants were willing to work for low pay. As a result, Americans lost jobs. They protested. Then, school officials in San Francisco barred Japanese children from attending school with white children. President Roosevelt opposed the decision. He asked the officials to lift the ban. In exchange, he agreed to ask Japan to stop its poor farmers and laborers from going to live in America. Japan said it would. The understanding became known as the Gentleman's Agreement.
Roosevelt worked hard to improve America's relations with Japan, yet he made clear that the United States would defend its interests in Asia and the Pacific. As a warning, he sent a naval force on a voyage around the world. The force included 16 battleships and 12,000 men. It was called the Great White Fleet. The voyage lasted 14 months. The fleet sailed down the Atlantic coast of South America. It went around the bottom of South America into the Pacific Ocean, then on to Hawaii, Australia, and Japan. Surprisingly, it received its warmest welcome in Japan. An American reporter said, "The fleet made a deep and far-reaching impression. It caused the Japanese to understand the great power of the United States, as nothing else could possibly have done." President Roosevelt believed this show of American strength prevented war with Japan. "Sending out the fleet," he said, "was the most important thing I did for peace."
Theodore Roosevelt greatly enjoyed playing the part of peacemaker. After successfully ending the war between Russia and Japan, he was asked to settle another international dispute. At issue was control over Morocco.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.